So have you ever dealt with a absolutely hostile person? Yes. Second question, are you a hostile person? Oh yeah, I wreak havoc wherever I go. No, I have dealt with him. So you've dealt with a hostile person? Yeah, now sometimes it's somebody that's, you know, outside your world, and those are easier to handle. If it's from inside your world, like inside the church, those you don't see coming, and you get blindsided, broadsided. They're very painful. I've dealt with hostile people. I actually thought when I became a pastor that everybody would just like me and ministry would be awesome. Such is not the case. So you have people that enter your life and wreak havoc for a variety of reasons. When I was a young pastor in California at a church plant and watching it grow over the years, we eventually grew to the point where we needed our full-time youth pastor. So we did a search, national search, found a candidate that we thought was perfect for our church in Northern California. So we hired him, moved him out from North Carolina, and things were going great. He had a positive attitude, great Bible student. The Southern language, it just sounds like it's from God, doesn't it? And so, my family's from the South, brought him out from the South, and it was just great. Kids loved him, grew. And our little church full of unity and joy was flourishing. And then after a few months, things just started happening. There was this person having an argument with this person didn't like this person, and why'd you say this about my wife, and all this stuff. It just took off like a snowball. So we lost our unity, and it became like a chaotic war zone. And, I'm going around trying to figure out where's this coming from, what's the origin, we need to stop this, and I could never get any info to give me the intel as to who's causing this and that kind of stuff. So I went on vacation at one point. On vacation, I got a phone call from the chairman of the elder board. And he said, I know we're not supposed to call you on vacation, but I need to talk to you. I'm like, oh, okay. About what? And he said, well, there was a felonious accusation leveled against one of our volunteers. Prosecutable. He said, we as elders, because elders are spiritual leaders of the church, they're also part-time detectives. Did you know this? They really are. And one of the guys on our board was a detective. So he was the head of homicide. Okay? So he was on the board. So we had some, another federal agent. We had some very interesting men on the board. And they did a little searching around about this felonious statement, because they had to. And they discovered the origin of the statement and the person who made it. And they brought that person for an interview before the elder board. It was the youth pastor. So they presented the evidence to the youth pastor to say, are you the origin of this felonious statement? Yes. Why in the world would you do that? What he would do is he would go around and anybody in his way, he would destroy them and get them out of his way so he could propel himself to greater power in the church. Never saw this coming. He wreaked havoc on my life. It was terrible. He said things about me too, and I'm like, where is this coming from? That's totally not me. I don't even roll that way. So when all of that happened, and the elder told me that they had discovered all this, we realized that something had to be done, The elders asked him, what was your motivation in destroying the unity of the church and making felonious statements against, a person in question that you wanted to get out of your way so you could propel yourself? I mean, what was your motivation in doing all this? This is what he said. He said, my motivation was to create such havoc in the church that you would fire Marty and hire me. Would you call that a hostile person? Yeah, I never saw him coming. He didn't look like a hostile person. You'd say hi to him. Hey, how you doing? What? Praise God, brother. I mean, it was like that all the time. Behind the scenes, it was a whole nother thing. I've dealt with those kind of people, and those kind of people cause you to pause and look at yourself and consider, Lord, how can I handle this kind of person? I remember the day I fired him because I didn't have a choice. So I told him, I said, I can protect you from anything. I'm the umbrella of authority over your ministry. I'm game to protect you. But I can't protect you if you perpetually lie. And he said, well, I learned how to do that from my father. And my father taught me how to lie and how to be a good liar and to get what I want by lying. Unbelievable, isn't it? So there was the last youth service that he was in. I went to smaller church, about 180 people. I didn't have a big staff at the time. So the day I fired him, he had to finish out his job. And and lead that youth group. And then I had to usher him out of the building, get his keys. And I remember when I opened the back door to let him out, that's where his car was, because that's where the youth room was, around the back side of the building. You know, I told him, I had expected greater things from you, but I hope God will do greater things in your life. I hope you will learn from this, and greater things can come from this, but you left me no choice, and I'm sorry I have to remove you. He started crying, got in his car, and drove off into the rain, and I never saw him again. That was the first staff person I ever had to let go. It was not simple. It's never simple. But when he's openly hostile and destroying the church, guess what? I have to deal with that. The elders had to deal with that. He was basically my first exposure to Saul, because he was like Saul. So when you deal with a person like that, let's call this guy Doug. And if your name is Doug here today, don't freak out. It's not you, okay? Just a fictitious name. So if you ever have been blindsided by a Doug, how do you roll? This hostile person. When you get into chapter 19, God's going to tell you how to deal with Doug. And that's what we're going to learn. So if you are Doug, I'm here to tell you that there's room at the cross of Christ for you, as we're going to talk about. If you're the object of Doug's hostility, God's going to give you some wisdom and insight how to go forward. Before we do that, we need to review, because it's been 2 weeks. And as I say, and have said for years, it's a little statement I say. Some people quote it to me, brain cells die daily. It's just truth, isn't it? Yeah. And so we just forget stuff. And so so we want to review, because you might have forgotten what chapter 17 was about. So let's review what 17 was about. In 17, there was a giant. His name? Goliath. Mocking the Israelite troops. No one will take him on. And finally, somebody steps forward to say, I could totally take him on. Who was it? David. What kind of weapon did he use? Slingshot. Did he have armor? No armor. No armor. Going up against a guy almost 10 feet tall with total armor. He had how many stones? Five. How many did he use? Just one. When did he load his weapon? While he ran. I don't know about you. I would have had it loaded up before I took off running. He's so confident he can hit him. He loads while he's running. Takes him out. Israel is so excited. Goliath hits the dust. David is awesome. That's chapter 17. David's the new anointed king, but he's not king yet because Saul's still king. Chapter 18. The people come back into town celebrating David's great win, as rightly they should, and the girls are singing a song. And the song extols Saul as the king and really extols David as being the awesome warrior. How'd that go over with King Saul? Not so good. That triggered in him two sins. Do you remember what they were? First one starts with J. Jealousy, and the other one starts with E. Envy. So jealousy, he was jealous of the fact that this young man could potentially take away my kingship. And he's envious that, man, I wish I was a warrior like that. And so that triggered him to want to get rid of him. So the very guy who's going to bless the nation, ultimately, the king wants to eliminate because he's getting in on my power base. And so when we get to chapter 9, well, just to review chapter 18, he attempts to get rid of David, his competition. First he throws a spear at him. Then he tells him, okay, I missed you, because he's good at dodging spears. So then he says, well, then I'll get you to marry my oldest daughter. How'd that work? Well, if you marry her, you got to pay a dowry. The dowry is going to be go and do X amount of military campaigns. And when you do however many I tell you to do, once you reach the max and are victorious, then you can marry her. David looked at her and said, I ain't marrying her. She's not for me. I'm not doing it. So he didn't do it. Because he wanted to kill David on the battlefield, right? Let somebody else do the dirty work. So then he finds out that his other daughter really loves David because he's a good looking guy, great warrior. And he's like, man, I can use this. So I tell you what, David, if you marry my other daughter, I'll give her to you. But the dowry is 100 foreskins of dead Philistines. I know it's gross, but that's what he said, 100 foreskins. And David's like, yeah, I'd like to marry her. I'll bring you 200 foreskins. And he did. So 3 episodes to try to kill his competition. He's not effective. It's like he's, did you watch Star Trek back in the day? It's like force field around the Enterprise. Anything the Klingons do, it just doesn't work, you know? This is like, David's like invincible. I've tried to take him out. You think Saul would have connected the dots and said, he's the anointed of God. I'm not. I need to step back and let David ascend. Mm-mm. Because 2 things controlled Saul, jealousy and envy. Now we get to the sermon, verse 1. We begin to learn about how to deal with the Saul type. It says, now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all of his servants to extol David and celebrate his awesomeness. Mm-mm. No, because David is the object of Saul's jealousy and envy. So Saul's like, I've tried three times to take him out. We got to do something different. All of us need to get together in the royal court and work to kill him. Isn't it interesting how when you have a great person in a culture like a David that God is really using, and people are envious and jealous of him, want to kill him, want to silence him? And so he says, we need to get together to kill him. Chrysostom, the church father, said years ago, as a moth gnaws a garment, so doth envy consume a man. It will consume you. And Saul's consumed. And so you might be struggling with those sins of jealousy and envy. It's time to go to the cross of Christ and say, God, cleanse me and move me on. That's his rule. We need to go out and figure out a way to kill him. Verse 1b through 7 is the reasoning, because things aren't going to go the way Saul realized them to go. It says in verse 1b, but Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So the very first word, if you took my Bible study hermeneutics class and remember everything we talked about, yeah. So the very first thing that you would note here is the very first word. It's the word but, right? So it states a contrast, right? Now, so in the Hebrew text, that is a coordinating conjunction and. It's called a vav. W-A-W, where the W's in Hebrew sound like V's in German. Anyway, so you're supposed to have a verb in the Hebrew sentence, but it's not. It's a coordinating conjunction wedded to the name Jonathan, a non-verb. So what about it? We study grammar here. When you have a non-verb wedded to a coordinating conjunction, it's highly emphatic. The king wants David killed, but his own son, the next in line for the throne, likes him. Oh, this is a problem. This is a problem. You would think that, well, the king's son wants to become the king and assume the power over the nation, but he's like, no, David's the anointed. I've seen it in him, and I love this guy. Wow, he took out Goliath. He needs to be the king. You know, it's really hard to get people to turn loose of power, isn't it? We understand that in D.C., don't we? You got leaders like, how old are they? How old are they? You know what I mean? It's like, how long have they been in office? Shouldn't there be a term limit? I mean, hello, Walker, oxygen tank? I mean, what? You know? And they just won't stop. You know? And they might have had a great career, but at some point you want to go, like if you see me up here when I'm 90, just talk to me. You know? It's Marty, time to move on. Saul won't let it go. But Jonathan's like, I don't want to be the king. I can turn loose of power. He's at his prime. He doesn't want to be the king. Why? Well, because God chose David, not me. That's why he's such a great guy. Now, here's what I want you to think about when Jonathan steps forward here and delights in David. He's going to be used of God to defend David. So here's the point. When you're dealing with Doug and your life's going south, because you're dealing with Doug and it's hostile and it's not nice and your life's falling apart, you're losing sleep, God's like, oh, hey, I've got this. I'm working on somebody who has, well, higher pay grade than you, who can step into this situation, who can help you with it. You got to trust me. Your Jonathan's going to come forward. See, for me, as best I tried to figure out who's destroying the church behind the scenes and attacking me as the pastor, who is this? I could never get to the bottom of it, but the detectives on my elder board did. I mean, they really did. And so I can name those men. Those men stepped in and helped me. They were my Jonathan. And so I learned as a young man, don't fret over Doug. If you're doing God's work, God's going to send you a Jonathan. Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. You might need that data point, David. Now, therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I'm going to go and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and you're going to find a place to hide in the field. I'll speak to my father about you. If I found out anything, then I shall tell you. So what's going on here? He's like, hey, look, my dad wants to take you out. I'm going to go defend you to my father. And if it's a positive outcome, you can just pop out of your hiding place and things will be awesome. If it's not great, you can just stay in your hiding place and we'll figure out something to do. That's what's going on. So next day, Jonathan took his father to task. They went to a chosen location and he is going to confront his father. Have you ever confronted your father? Have you anybody ever done it? I've done it. It's an uncomfortable thing. And it's a scary thing. It's your father. Now, you don't, if you do it when you're five, that's one thing. But if you're 25, that's a whole nother thing. And so Paul wrote many years later, 1 Thessalonians 5:14, "We urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, cheer the faint-hearted, support the weak, and be patient with all." Those are hard things to do. But if somebody is idle, won't work, and get their act together, Christians are known for working hard, setting the pace. He said, you need to admonish them. What? To work. But it's the idea of admonishing. You go to somebody who's not living the life, and they're inconsistent, maybe a hypocrite, and telling them, hey, brother, I love you, but your life's compromised. His son is going to go confront his dad. That's gutsy. It says in verse 4, Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and he said to him, notice his logical, reasoned argument like an attorney. Notice what he says. Do not let the king sin against his servant David. Why? Argument one. Well, since he has not sinned against you, that would be one reason. Second reason, since his deeds have been very, very beneficial for you. Well, what do you mean? Well, he took his life in his hands and he struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel, and you saw it, and what? You rejoiced. You were there. You saw it. Why then will you sin against an innocent blood by putting David to death without cause? Why, Dad, would you do that? This guy's done nothing to you. He took out Goliath, and you want to kill him? Dad, you certainly don't want to kill an innocent man, right? How do you deal with the Doug type who's highly emotionally unbalanced? Use facts. The cold, hard facts. That's what my elder council did. They used the cold, hard facts to confront the perpetrator, to get them to confess. That's what he's doing with his dad. He's getting him the cold, hard facts. So what's happening here? God is using a Jonathan to defend David. You must ask yourself, who's my Jonathan? God, send me a Jonathan, because that's what God does. Jonathan confronts his father, and according to verse 6, it's very interesting what we read in verse 6. Saul did what? Listened to the voice of David. And Saul vowed, and this sounds super spiritual. What did he vow? As the Lord lives. It's kind of like Yul Brynner. You know what I'm talking about? As it is written, so let it be done. You saw the movie? Yeah. As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. Great. Progress made? Sounds like it. But we know from studying the book thus far that Saul has issues. Right? He has a problem that we encountered in chapter 14, verses 24 and 44. He has a problem with, he selectively obeys vows. I only obey them if they advance me. I don't have to obey them all the time. He's good at giving rash vows and not following through on them. So he says the right thing. So it looks like there's restoration. So the greatest thing, like in my last church, that could have happened if Doug was restored with me and the elder council and other people he'd said things about. That would have been great. That didn't happen. But it looks like you have restoration here, which is what you want. Verse 7, Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan, this is shocking, did what? Brought David to Saul. And he was in his presence as formerly. Interesting. Sounds great so far. But I would say to you, if God works through a Jonathan to get you to reconcile with somebody who was hostile to you, still use your brain, okay? Don't totally let your guard down. Why? Keep reading. Because when we get to verses 8 to 11, it's called the relapse. What happens? When there was war again, David went out and fought with the Philistines. How'd he do? Defeated him with great slaughter, so that they fled before him, scared to death of David. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. Not a good look. And David was playing the harp in his hand. How's this going to go? We've seen this before. And Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away out of his presence so that he stuck the spear in the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. This is amazing. Now I have to stop because not everybody comes to church. You should never miss church. Because there was a man in our last service who'd missed the service where I talked about this. So I have to, I told him I can't explain every component of every passage every single time. Okay. But I will stop just to address the fact that an evil spirit went out from the Lord. I mean, is God evil? Is he the author of evil? No. Well, what's he doing sending a demon? It's the difference between permission and promotion. You follow me? Permission and promotion. Which do you think God did here? He permitted it. He did not promote it. Why? Because he's holy. But he permits it. And if you have a problem with that, read Job 1. Because Because in the courtroom of God, Satan, the accuser, is allowed into the throne room of God with his angels. Because go read Revelation, when the archangel kicks him out in the tribulation of that room, the courtroom, God allows him there for debate and discussion. And what God finally does here is say, you're going to reap what you sow, Saul. You want to reap judgment? Okay, I will let that happen to you. I protected you as I protected Job, but I will remove my protective barrier, and the demonic spirit that wants to afflict you negatively, I will permit him, not promote him. I will step back and sovereignly let him loose. So we can move on? Okay. So he gets triggered. What triggers Saul to throw a spear again? And this is your father-in-law. Would you like this to be your father-in-law? Every time I do something that's great, guy tries to kill me. Throws a spear at him. He's obviously good after multiple battles of hand-to-hand combat with the Philistines. David can duck spears. I mean, he's good at this. And so what triggers Saul? The fact that David is successful. If you are Saul, you have to stop and ask yourself, what is it that triggers me about person X? And then, this makes me jealous. It makes me envious. This is what you take to God and say, God, can you help me? If you're the object of the hatred of a Saul type, just realize that even your best exploits for God, your advancements in life and things that you do are great, even that can be turned against you and leave you in shock. David flees his presence, and according to biblical scholars, they estimate that David, the relationship that was appeared to be reunited is now fractured. That David is now separated from Saul and on the run from Saul for 10 years. Leads to a question that I've asked before. I'll ask it again. Why didn't God just make David the king? Ipso facto, you're the king. No, because what's God doing in those 10 years? He's taking Saul out of David. Do you hear me? He's taking Saul out of David. See, when I face Doug, what's God doing with me and Doug? God's saying, Marty, there's some things that I need to hone in your life. And those honing opportunities, they're never pleasant. They're always difficult. So I'm going to hone your character. I'm going to shape your character. God's worried about the inner man, not the outer man. We're worried about the outer man. God's like, no, I'm concerned about the inner man. He's going to take David and hone him by causing him to deal with Saul and Saul with him. And so he wants a man that loves him all the time. He doesn't want a man that's selective in obedience. He wants a man that's loyal as opposed to disloyal. He's going to spend 10 years of David on the run, living in caves, eating out of streams, begging food from people, all the stuff he does, that when he gets David to be the humble man that he really wants him to be, then he makes him the king. So I'm just telling you, whatever God's doing through your Doug experience right now, he's shaping and honing you. Thank him for it. And say, God, what do you want me to learn? And he will teach you. Verse 11 is interesting because we run into David's wife, Michal. She's somewhat like her dad. We call it the rescue. Saul is all about killing David. It says in verse 11 that he sent messengers over David's house to watch him in order to put him to death. He wants to kill David in his daughter's house. Imagine, what a heartless father. The rescue comes in verse 11b, but Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you're going to be put to death. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went out and he fled and he escaped. And Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair at its head, and he covered it with the clothes. When David sent his messengers to take David, she said, he's sick in bed. You can't kill a man when he's sick. You see? This is like Hollywood stuff. Like, if you're sitting there going, the Bible is so boring. Man, I don't know what you're reading. I read and go, that is so interesting. David's wife, Michal, I mean, she gets a household idol, which leads to a whole other question. You know what I'm saying? When you preach expositionally, you can't preach around stuff. What's the question? Why is it there? Why is it there? Well, I don't think it came from David. He's a man after God's own heart. Probably came from her. Because she comes from a family that's got all kinds of compromise issues, right? There's a household idol in it. Was it a big idol or a small idol? It's a big one. It's a big. Like, she could stick it in the bed and take some goat hair. Must have been gross. Put it around the top so it looks like David's locks. And it actually looks like a man's in the bed. I mean, she might have had to have someone come help her pick it up. Can you help me put the idol in the bed? He's tired, you know? Like, this is weird, you know? Covered up, you know? Yeah. And so the soldiers come in and see the body, and they're like, Saul, we can't take him, man. The guy, he's got the flu or something. It's totally lame, right? Where did she learn the art of scheming? What say you? It's a softball question. Her dad. Where did she learn the art of lying? Her father. Yeah, from her father. Where this household idol came from? Probably because her father was compromised too. This family's got issues. It says in verse 15, Saul sent messengers to see David, saying, listen to what he says. He's totally desperate. Bring him up to me. What? On. Notice prepositional phrase. On his bed. I mean, if he's asleep in that bed, just bring the bed with him on it. I so want to take him out. Just pick him up and bring him to me. Unbelievable. Verse 16, when the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed with the quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this? And let my enemy, your husband, go so that he escaped. And Michal said to him, notice her answer. This is interesting. Dad, I'm throwing this in. Dad, David said to me, let me go. Why should I put you, my wife, to death? Translated, if you don't let me go, honey, I'm going to kill you. Did David say that? No. What is she doing? Lying. Lying. Leads to a question. Is it right to lie? I can tell you what the last service said. They said no. Is it right to lie? What say you? No, no. Does the Bible say you shouldn't lie? Yeah, it does. But the point is, you might get put in situations, life or death situations, where a little deception might save someone's life. Then what do you do? Okay? So let's think about lying for just a minute. Rachel and Jacob, remember them in the Old Testament? Yep. Yeah. Genesis chapter 27. They set up a situation to lie to Isaac and to get the blessing to go down to Isaac, his line through the Messiah, etc. But it's all done online and conniving. Unbelievable. And it's presented in a negative fashion if you read that chapter. So it's like, okay, God's against lying. He didn't like what Isaac and his mom did. Okay. Well, then what about the midwives in Exodus chapter 1? Remember them? Yeah. Do you remember their names? Shipra and Puah. Those were their names. What did they do? Pharaoh said, every time you see a male baby, you're the midwives, kill it. We don't want any deliverer coming to Israel. Kill every male baby. What'd they do? They saved every baby. Why? More important to save a life than to tell the political leader the truth. Interesting. Were they rewarded for their actions? Yeah, just read Exodus 1. God rewarded them. God rewarded them. In the field of ethics, we know that God hates lying. Exodus 20, 16 says he does. Proverbs 11, 3 says God hates falsehood. Sure he does. And in John 8, 44, Jesus actually says to the political leaders, Satan is the father of lies. Absolutely. But in the field of life, you come to complexities where you might have a situation, it's life or death, and you have to illustrate in your life, there's a moral conflict. What's more important? Saving a life or telling the truth? What'd Rahab the harlot do? She lied about the spies. And when you get to Hebrews chapter 11, she's in the hall of faith. Why? Because she hid the spies. What was more important that day? Saving the life of the spies was more important. Dr. Norman Geisler, whom I studied under in grad school for my doctorate in apologetics, said this one day. It's called graded absolutism. Graded. That some things are more important than other things. Here's what he says. He says, there is a hierarchy of virtue that moral duties sometimes conflict, and they do in life, and that we are not culpable for obeying the higher duty. He said, there's a pyramid of value with God on the top, persons in the middle, things on the bottom. Charles Hodge, great theologian, once said, the principle itself, a graded absolutism, is clearly inculcated by our Lord when he said, I will have mercy and not sacrifice. And when he also taught that it was right to violate the Sabbath in order to save a life. Jesus did that, did he not? And he illustrates sometimes in certain situations they're exceptional. You've got to do this because it's higher than this. Geiser went on to illustrate that there's higher and moral laws. Quote, perhaps the clearest indication of higher and lower moral laws comes in Jesus' answer to the lawyer's question about the greatest commandments. Jesus affirms that the first and greatest commandment is above the second, that loving God is supreme of importance, and then below that comes loving one's neighbor. One is more important than the other, but they're both important. He says, the popular belief is wrong that all sins are not created equal, for they are clearly higher and lower moral laws. So in McCall's situation, what did she do? She surveyed the situation. Which is more important? My dad wants to kill an innocent man. Murder him. What's more important? Well, I hold my dad at bay with a little twist into this or that, and I protect my husband's life. That's more important. And then she would sort the rest out. So exceptional situations call for exceptional activity, and then you go back to observing the things that God has said you should do, correct? Not that I'm telling you to go out and lie and deceive, no. But in certain situations, like Corrie Ten Boom, right? Nazis are coming to kill the Jews. What did she do with her family? She hid them in the house with their parents, with their sister, etc., to keep them from being executed and sent to Auschwitz, etc. So, amazing daughter who stepped forward to protect her husband. Verses 18 to 24 is what I would call the rout. It's most interesting. It says, David fled and escaped and came to who? Samuel. See, this is like me. When I'm facing Doug, who do I go to? The guys in my life that I can really trust, my elders, and tell them, I don't know what's going on here. I need you guys to come alongside me and help me. They came alongside me. Sometimes you need them to come alongside you. David fled and went to Samuel, Ramah, and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he said to Samuel, he and Samuel went and stayed at Nioth, which is where the prophets were from, the school. Saul had spies everywhere, so it came in verse 19 that was told to Saul, hey, behold, David is in Nioth and Ramah. So what did Saul do? He continued to do lame things. It says in verse 20, Saul sent messengers to take David, but when they saw the company of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing presiding over them, this is funny. They went to go kill David. What happened to them? The Spirit of God came upon these hitmen, messengers of Saul, and they did what? Yeah, they're going to take David out. And all of a sudden, they get near the prophetic school, and they all start prophesying uncontrollably, and they can't stop themselves. Baruch Adonai Ha'elahenu. I mean, they're just, blessed is God. I mean, huh? What happened there? God's in control. So what did Saul do when he found out that that's what happened? Verse 21, Saul, they told it to Saul, and he sent other messengers. What happened to them? Group two became prophets. So Saul sent messengers a third time. What happened to them? They lost control and started prophesying. I mean, I'm reading this, and I'm going, this is the David derangement syndrome. I mean, isn't it? He's so consumed with them, with his jealousy and envy. Like, he can't even think straight. Man after man after man, and they all became Pentecostal prophets. And he can't stop himself. So what does he do? Verse 22. He himself went to Ramah. Can't you just see this? Well, if they can't handle the business, I'm stepping in. Okay? And he came as far as the large well that is in Sekou, and he asked and he said, because everybody hangs out at the well. That's where the water is. So it's the watering hole, you know? Where's Samuel and David? And someone said, behold, they are in Naoth in Ramah. So what'd he do? Saul moseyed on down there with the intent of doing what? Killing him. What happens when he gets there? He proceeded from there to Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. What happened when that happened? Well, he went along prophesying continually until he came to Ramah. And he, what happened when he got to Ramah? Well, he uncontrollably stripped off his clothes. Starts taking off the robe, the tunic, the whole thing. And he too prophesied before Samuel, and he lay down naked all day and night for 24 straight hours prophesying, and he can't stop himself. He's at the feet of the guy who used to be the leader, and he's laying at his feet showing, I am a servant to you, Samuel, and you are a servant to God. I can't help but fall prostrate before God's greatness. And he's prophesying great things. I would assume, I'm going to ask David when I get there, was he prophesying about you? Because I bet he was. That's totally ironic. Isn't this amazing? It was so amazing that people came up with that byword saying again, is Samuel among the prophets? I mean, serious? I mean, what happened to the guy? What happened to the guy? God said, you're trying to take out the anointed. I protect the anointed, God says. Jonathan's going to protect him. His wife is going to protect him. And when you try to take him out yourself, I will make it to where you can't even physically do it. I don't know who your Saul is right now. You do. Or Doug. But I do know this. Main idea of the passage is this. When someone wants to silence you, What's God doing? He works to secure you. Why? So you can carry out his will. When God wants to deal with that person, he will deal with him. But when they're trying to silence you, God said, no, that's my anointed. I don't know where you're at, Pentagon, whatever army unit you're with, whatever, whoever is your Saul. God's like, I'm bigger than them. I can even control their body to turn them and make them praise me. The other thing that's great about God is sometimes he gets the attention of Saul because he wanted nothing better than to save Saul from his situation. In my situation with Doug, I had been here for probably 7 or 8 years here. So many years after the fact of firing this young man. So I'd been here for many years, and one day the secretary called me on the phone and said, there's someone out here in the lobby they want to talk to you. I'm like, well, I'm kind of busy. They said they really need to talk to you, so can you come out here? I'm like, okay. So I went out there and walked around the corner, and it was Doug and his wife and children. And the children are now bigger because it's been many years. And it was kind of uncomfortable for a minute, and then I asked the question that you would ask. What are you doing here? Like, how'd you find me? And he's like, well, I've been following you. You know, since you fired me, I've been following you. Like, oh, that's kind of creepy, you know? And he said, yeah, I realize you're on the East Coast now. And he said, I'm from North Carolina. I'm back in North Carolina. And he said, we drove up here today to talk to you. Well, about what? And he said, well, I just came up here to tell you face to face, man to man, thank you for firing me. He said, you firing me changed my life. He said, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. He said, I had a lot of time thinking going across the United States when we moved back. And he said, I did a lot of confessing. And he said, I'm here to confess today. I was a perpetual liar because my father taught me how to do it. And I did it. I was totally culpable. You had every right to fire me. But I have confessed that all to God. And he's forgiven me. And now I have a wonderful ministry as a senior pastor at a church in North Carolina. And God has blessed me greatly. Isn't that amazing? That's what God did in Doug's life. So if you are Doug, God's grace is greater. Just avail yourself of it, and he'll change you. It's good to have you in God's house, and I pray that God gives you wisdom as you face Doug or Saul. Let's pray. God, thank you for the opportunity to worship you, minister, and guide us and lead us as only you can, and we will praise your great and holy name for who you are and how you help us in the complexities of life. In Christ's name, amen.